Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this afternoon, the Massachusetts State Senate has been debating sweeping police reform legislation that aims to reimagine the way we approach community safety and increase accountability for law enforcement. Among other things, it includes limits on the use of force by law enforcement officers and the creation of a new independent entity to certify officers. Rahsaan Hall, director of the Racial Justice Program for the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, has been a longtime voice among the calls for police reform in the Commonwealth and joins us now to talk about the bill that's being debated. Welcome to Radio Boston, Rahsaan.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want you to pull up a chair too. What kind of police reform do you think we need? How should we reimagine community safety? If we reinvest money in community safety, where do those investments go? And what to make of the idea of diverting police responsibilities to social workers, for example? Would that work? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so Rahsaan, thinking about the protests we've seen in the last, really we're in our third month of them now. Does this Senate bill rise to the occasion and answer the calls we've been hearing from protesters and activists?
It certainly had the potential to, and so I was a part of the press conference that announced it, and in being a part of that press conference, I was certainly hopeful that there were a lot of elements that were touched on that would either stay there or become better. But what I'm hearing from the debate that's currently happening is that it is actually getting weakened, and it does not actually capture the demands and the concerns of the people in the community who are most directly impacted by aggressive, violent, and racist policing.
As information is coming in and you're hearing about this weakening that's happening, are there particular aspects of the bill as it went into today that are being weakened?
A huge concern for the ACLU and many other advocates for police reform or police abolition is the elimination of qualified immunity. Qualified immunity is a legal doctrine that protects police officers from civil liability for conduct that they are engaged in that is a violation of their rights. That legal doctrine has been expanded so much to the point that it is tantamount to absolute immunity. And so that is an element that we were hoping would have been addressed. And we're hearing that it may not be as strong as what was proposed and may even be weakened. There is also a face surveillance moratorium or ban on face surveillance technology that was initially included, but it had a sunset provision on it. We were hoping that that would be eliminated until the legislature comes up with recommendations or standards for the appropriate use of law enforcement or appropriate governmental use of face surveillance technology. That has not happened. And then there are concerns around limits on use of force. It does not outright ban chokeholds or the use of tear gas or eliminate no-knock warrants. And so although it may create a duty to intervene when one officer sees a fellow officer engaging in misconduct, the fact that George Floyd was murdered by a technique that is tantamount to a chokehold, that is not explicitly prohibited and not given any exceptions, is highly problematic.
So Rahsaan, just so our listeners are clear on this, you're talking about these are things that as the bill is going through the process today are either being stripped away or changed in the language. This is the Senate side of the Massachusetts State House. Governor Baker released his own bill last month that had some of the same provisions and some different ones. We don't have a bill from the House yet. Is that correct?
That's correct. My understanding is that the House is working on a bill, but they haven't released anything as of yet.
Do you feel that the changes that we're seeing as the Senate debate happens today might affect what is in the House bill when they bring it forward?
It's really hard to tell. The Massachusetts legislature is a unique creature in that there is not a lot of transparency on how the decisions get made. Certainly there are conversations that people have, and some advocates have access to information. But as far as a open and public debate and process, that really doesn't happen. So it's not entirely clear what is or is not going to be included in the House version of the bill. We're hopeful that there are bold progressive reforms included in there, especially given this moment that we're in, but we won't know until we actually see it.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation on police reform in the Commonwealth and the bill that's being debated in the Senate today. Austin's on the line from Needham. Austin, go ahead.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, thanks.
So I just wanted to say that I think the conversation that we're having right now is really awesome. I think a lot of the sort of rhetoric that looks to move funding from police to social workers is really cool. But I also think a part of the conversation that's being left out is the way that youth and sort of like grassroots education, but also governance should work to minimize the contact with police in like, you know, vulnerable communities. For example, at my school, we do something called peer health education, where peers educate each other on things like sexual health, mental health, drug and alcohol use. And I think that that's something that could be fruitfully introduced to the conversation as something that, you know, we could also look at as an option for institution building.
Thank you, Austin. Let me turn back to you, Rahsaan, and I'm going to take Austin's call and give you two questions on it. One, to your knowledge, to what extent were community organizations and those representing youth who have been very much in the driver's seat in a lot of the protests that have been happening in the last several weeks, where have youth voices been in development of this kind of legislation? And two, it sounds like some of what Austin is talking about is what might happen with money that would be reallocated away from a police budget and into social services and social work types of budgets. So maybe a chance for you to reflect on those two things.
Sure. As far as the young people who have been engaged in activism and speaking truth to power, who I am extremely proud of and honored to be in touch and communication with some of them. Some of the bills or the elements that were included in the Senate bill, like expanding juvenile expungement and raising the age of juvenile jurisdiction, were included in this bill. And those were pieces of legislation from prior legislative sessions that were advocated for by young people. And so to the extent that they had a hand in some of the pieces that were folded into this omnibus bill, they were considered. But in this last round, recognizing the complications of the legislative process and this unique political moment and the lowercase p politics of trying to navigate a bill through the legislature, I don't know or am not aware of any of the young advocates and activists who have been out in the streets and making these demands, what role they had, or I'm not aware of any involvement that they had in the particular crafting of this bill beyond, making calls to legislators and having previously been supportive of pieces of legislation that were ultimately folded into this. As far as this shift or reallocation of funding to go towards more social service-oriented programming, I feel that that is tremendously important. That is what one of the primary concerns have been. The ACLU has signed on to the Movement for Black Lives call to defund police. We work to the best of our abilities in partnership with community organizations like Families for Justice's Healing, who are calling for more resources to be invested in community-based programming that addresses the underlying needs that people have. A majority of what police respond to and deal with are things that grow out of poverty, that grow out of mental health issues, that grow out of substance use disorder. And if we were to make sure that people's needs were met, we wouldn't have such a need for police to begin with.
So Rahsaan, we're going to actually dive further into that with some other voices in just a couple of minutes. I understand you're going to stay with me and kind of ride along through those conversations. We'll also be hearing a law enforcement perspective. But before I start to bring those other voices in your role at ACLU and as you've been working on this, have you engaged with law enforcement officers or leadership about these reforms, and what kinds of reactions have you been getting?
Yeah, we've been in conversation with legislative leadership and lawmakers to express the concerns. Our top priorities in this moment have been creating a ban on face surveillance, the government use of face surveillance technology, eliminating qualified immunity, and putting severe restrictions on police use of force, including the elimination or banning of chokeholds, no-knock warrants, rubber bullets, tear gas. And so those are some of the things that we have expressed. We have been in conversation with law enforcement in the past, not necessarily around this piece of legislation. And so there is an understanding of where our advocacy is coming from. There have certainly been efforts to try to incorporate our policy demands or advocacy points that we've been making. But, you know, there's also been a significant pushback from law enforcement. And that's part of the reason we think that this, what we're hearing is that this bill is being watered down or pieces are being taken out because of the feedback the legislators have received from police officers.
Okay, Rahsaan, stay with us, please. I want to start bringing in some other voices, especially because one component of the state Senate bill calls for reallocating resources and responsibilities away from police departments into social workers and other community resources. So we wanted to bring in a voice from a community who made that change 30 years ago. Eugene, Oregon implemented a collaboration between police and a community service called the White Bird Clinic. The partnership means that a medic and a crisis worker can respond to 911 calls with police or instead of police. So let's hear a little more about that. Joining me now is Kelsey Christensen. She's a reporter with KVAL CBS 13 in Eugene. Kelsey, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So Kelsey, the program's called CAHOOTS. Briefly, how does it work?
So basically, if you hear of a first responder, this is kind of a fourth type of first responder. So they're trained, you know, exponentially in crisis management, mental health, intoxication calls, de-escalation, you name it, almost 10 times the rate of police officers. So what actually happens is they partner up with EPD, which is the Eugene Police Department, and the dispatch center for both take a call. And if they deem it that CAHOOTS needs to respond because it's a mental health crisis or needs de-escalation, they go alongside police if there's a threat. But they also respond to calls that may just be intoxication or without a threat so that police don't need to be involved.
So why was it implemented in the first place, Kelsey? And what pushed this forward? 30 years ago was a long time ago for this kind of change.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, White Bird started. They're the founder of CAHOOTS. And basically, the community felt a need. You know, Eugene is a pretty progressive city, as many of you know, but it also has a super high homeless population. So even when CAHOOTS started, you know, they didn't have too many calls as the homeless population has grown here. But even within the last 5 years, it's more than doubled its calls. They take about 20% of the calls off of the Eugene Police Department. So that's kind of where it stems from.
And has it been effective, Kelsey, especially, I mean, what's the police's perspective on it, its success? What's the community perspective on its success?
Yeah, you know, overall, I'd say it's highly successful. I mean, CAHOOTS being on the show, it's really in the national spotlight for a lot of cities, especially after the murder of George Floyd. We've had a lot of cities call asking for CAHOOTS members to come in and help train them. Not that it's really a cookie cutter program that you can place anywhere. But I mean, yeah, the community support has been great, and also the police support, because, you know, as I said, they take 20% of the calls from the Eugene Police Department, which already responds to a myriad of things, but it kind of takes a weight off of their shoulders because they only have so much training in de-escalation and crisis management, which, you know, there are a lot of calls like that here. So having, you know, that fourth kind of first responder to take on those calls and de-escalate them without having firearms at the situation, they're definitely for it.
All right, that's Kelsey Christensen, a reporter with KVAL CBS 13 in Eugene, Oregon. Kelsey, thanks for taking the time for us here in Boston today.
You bet. Good to be here.
So, Rahsaan, I'm about to turn around and get a law enforcement perspective, but before I do, just wanted to get a sense, your reactions from what we heard from Kelsey and how this kind of, some piece of this change that the Senate's debating here in the Commonwealth today works in another state.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are models that we want to look to. Again, police officers are called on and asked to do too many things that go beyond the scope of what policing should be about, to the extent that we have police, which is a separate conversation altogether. But again, the point I was making earlier about what it is police spend a majority of their time responding to are issues that grow out of poverty, homelessness, mental health issues, substance use disorder. So to the extent that we can invest greater amounts of resources in public health responses, education, housing security, addressing systemic racism, economic empowerment, those are the issues that are going to eliminate an overwhelming majority of the things that police are dealing with anyway. And so I think models like that are a better use of our resources. You look at Operation Clean Sweep, when the Boston Police Department went through a section of the city over by the South Bay House of Corrections and, you know, violated people's rights by stopping them and not allowing them to move, taking their name and then moving from them from a location, when these are a bunch of people who are experiencing homelessness and have substance use issues, instead of serving the underlying issues.
Although I will say, Rahsaan, and I do want to turn to Larry Ellison in a minute, I do want to say that the police at the time argued that a great number of the people that were arrested during that time actually weren't from Boston and might not have been qualified for Boston services at that time. I do want to bring Larry Ellison in here. Rahsaan, please do continue to stay with us. Larry Ellison is an officer with the Boston Police Department. He's on the board at MAMLEO, the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, and formerly served as MAMLEO's president. Officer Ellison, welcome back.
Good to be here. And hello, Rahsaan. How are you?
I'm good, Larry. How you doing, man?
Very good.
So, Officer Ellison, are you in favor of the police reform bill, let's say, as it went into deliberation in the state Senate today?
Well, I haven't seen it in its entirety, so there's some things in there that I have seen that are concerned. A big one being the immunity clause that's there. I think folks don't really understand, especially having been the president of the Minority Police Association, as well as currently serving on their board. But we all know that, you know, discipline is not meted out equally. So it concerns me that some folks, even with this new bill, will not be held accountable as others will be.
Can you talk a little bit more about that, more specifically where you're concerned about the disparities in people being held accountable?
Sure. I mean, Rahsaan Hall, in his prior, and I thank him for his service, you know, when he was with the Lawyers Committee, represented our organization in some of those cases, and with the disparate treatment, a drug testing policy that has finally come to an end because of its disparate treatment of officers of color who have been terminated at a larger rate. When it comes to complaints against officers of color, they're more likely to be taken and investigated and discipline meted out. You know, we have a policy now in our truthfulness policy, and that if you look at its numbers on the surface, Black officers are held accountable for untruthfulness, when a white officer in the same predicament will be said that he was inaccurate reporting and he will not be terminated. But if you are a person of color, the likelihood you'll be found responsible and terminated. So it's a very slippery slope that I think we're heading down without having precautions in there to make sure that people are held accountable equally.
So staying with the bill and a little bit on that theme, Officer, the bill would create the first certification process for law enforcement officers in the state. There's only a handful of states across the country that don't have some sort of certification. The bill would also allow for decertification of officers and create limits on where they could work if they'd been decertified. Mm-hmm. Is that a good thing?
Absolutely. Look, I'm not in disagreement with the bill as far as holding people accountable. I have conducted myself in that way for 35 years. So accountability is something, as long as it's done fairly, as long as it's meted out equally, I am in total agreement with that. I think it's like anything else. You have a driver's license or any other license, you have to renew most licenses, and people want to reevaluate whether or not you're doing a good job. I don't see a problem with that.
Rahsaan Hall of the ACLU and Officer Larry Ellison of Mamleo. Let's go to the phones. I'd like to get a call in here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got John on the line from Woods Hole. John, what's on your mind?
Well, the obvious compelling reform that would cut down on police violence against citizenry is to severely curtail the circumstances where the police arrest somebody and substitute it with a process of summoning people to court. You know, if you look at Floyd, if you look at Eric Garner, these were minor offenses, and the escalation of the physical violence was perpetrated when the police took the person under arrest. And it was totally unnecessary. So there should be legislation.
John, I'm going to take it back from you there because I want to make sure I've got time. We've only got a few minutes left in the segment, and I actually want to hear both of our guests' response to that suggestion. So let me start with you, Officer Ellison, and John, thanks again for that call.
Well, let me just say this. I don't think there's any legislation that's going to deal with all of the problems because you're dealing with human beings who come with their own biases, come with their own way of dealing with things. So no matter what bill is passed, it's not going to correct the behavior that you saw in Minnesota if that's the intentions of the officer, that they don't have those safeguards. You can deal with the aftermath of it, but it's not going to stop it.
And Rahsaan Hall.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I would take it a step further into Detective Ellison's point. Like, the problem is the institution of policing itself. So we could certainly summons more people. We could certainly decriminalize a lot more offenses to limit the type of exposure that people have with policing. But to Larry's point, you're still going to have police in this institution that are authorized by law to enforce the laws and take people's liberty and in some instances take their life. So it's really, the advocacy has really been about reducing the footprint and the power of policing altogether.
So I want to shift gears. You know, one place John could have gone with his comment was not we should do summonsing like a ticket, but he might have been speaking in support of this shifting of resources from law enforcement to social work and other professions that do trauma support and social determinants of health services, et cetera. We actually have had a social worker who was prepared to join us today, who we aren't going to be able to have time to bring on the air today. We will bring her back next week, and I want to thank her for being willing to appear on the show. But I do want to turn back to both of you and ask you, first, Officer Ellison, I haven't asked you yet, how do you feel about this reallocation of some funding to community support services?
Look, I think it's a great idea. You know, there have been many times that I've responded to a call and I'm sitting there scratching my head asking, why am I here? Is this really a police matter? I work in the schools and getting calls that there are 6 and 7 year olds out of control and people dial the police. And I'm like, why are the police being called for these type of services? There are a lot of services that we get called to because no one has anything else in place. And the police get there and things sometimes don't go the way they should. And it's not something that we're probably experts in or more proficient in as we should be. And things get out of control. So I have no problem with getting people the resources that they should, because it's not, doesn't mean that the police, we don't have all of the remedies in our bag.
Rahsaan, one of the conversations that we know happens as this idea gets discussed is concern that just as law enforcement officers may not have all the tools and training that they need to respond to trauma, mental health de-escalation, et cetera, that community workers may not have all of the training that they need to maybe confront a violent situation or deal with de-escalation appropriately, et cetera. How do we think about what the relationship and balance is in a successful formula going forward?
I think part of it begins with assessing what is actually out there. I think our imaginations are captured by the notions of what happens in the streets because of what we see on television. That's not to say that police officers do not respond to dangerous situations, but the overwhelming majority of policing that happens in our cities, especially in Black and brown communities and in poor communities, are incidents that do not involve violence. Or if it does, it's something that the police have escalated. And so if we had an honest assessment of the amount of police resources that are deployed to deal with societal issues, I think the conversation becomes less about, well, how do we deal with the worst of the worst and make sure that people, like, we don't want to send a social worker into an armed hostage negotiation situation. Those instances are so rare that the police are still equipped to deal with that, and we don't have to worry about that. But what we need to focus on is getting the types of resources and personnel into the community to deal with the underlying issues so that police don't have to respond, so that situations don't become escalated.
And Officer Ellison, I am on a hard clock. I have 30 seconds left. So just quickly, what are you hearing from the broader law enforcement community about the bill that's being discussed today?
Well, I hear a lot of people are saying they're heading to the exit because they feel like, you know, if they're trying to do their job and things don't go the way that they hope they would, that they'll be held accountable in a way that they haven't in the past. And like I said, we can't always say how things are going to turn out. So I think it's going to be very difficult to recruit officers going forward.
All right. And that is Officer Larry Ellison with the Boston Police Department. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome.
And Rahsaan Hall of the American Civil Liberties Union, I appreciate you joining the conversation as well.
Thank you for having me.